I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Harvard Law professor and legal activist Lawrence Lessig. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Lawrence Lessig.
Our guest this evening, Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig, is known as the Elvis of cyber law. One of the country's most influential theorists on the intersection of law, culture, and the internet, he has shifted focus to take on the corrosive effect of money on politics. Last year, Professor Lessig walked 200 miles for the New Hampshire Rebellion to encourage citizens to end the system of corruption in our nation's capital. The next walk starts this Sunday, and it's not too late to book a plane ticket and join him. Lawrence Lessig is here tonight to talk about Mayday PAC, his crowd-funded super PAC to end all super PACs, and what's in store for 2015. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming him to the JCCSF.
The weather, it is going to be incredibly cold in New Hampshire. The high right this minute is 6 degrees in the place that we're going to be starting our walk. So it's wonderful to be here, back in San Francisco, talking about something that I began here in San Francisco because I was forced to begin talking and thinking about this by a dear friend of many from San Francisco, Aaron Swartz, who, second anniversary of his death, is this Sunday, and whose memory is vibrant in this community and around the world. But what Aaron was focused on, he often described to me as simple justice. And as he talked to people about the simple injustice of the world that we find ourselves in, there was a growing frustration that he showed and that I followed. And one way to understand this frustration is to recognize the way in which we refuse to acknowledge the real nature of the problem we're talking about. So here's an example. America has been focused for the last year on a range of problems related to race in America. Michael Brown, Eric Garner, the injustice of the system, which we feel as a system of inequality, a system that gets described as a system of racism. And there is evidence to support the racism. This recent study of the racial distribution of deaths in 218 deaths involving police tries to map the predicted incidents according to race. And the predicted incidents for white are fewer than the actual incidents. And then you take this and draw this out to see what the actual differences are. And as the statistician summarizes, says the answer to the question, what is the probability that we would see a distribution as or more extreme than this one, assuming that race plays no factor in police-related deaths, is on order of 10 to the minus 82. Now, if you're not a mathematician, you might wonder, what's that number like? So you could compare it to this number, 10 to the minus 79, which is the probability of being hit by lightning 13 times in 1 year. Which means the probability of 10 to the minus 82 is a really, really, really small probability. Which is to suggest that there's a really high confidence in the judgment that the race of the victim is related to the violence. Now, there's lots of quibbles one could have with this study, but what comes through in our culture is this view that this manifests a certain kind of racism. And then that gets framed as if it's a racism of Bull Connor, or a racism of the 1960s, and the 50s, and the 40s, and the 30s, and all the way back. And there's no doubt, in my mind, that there are Jim Crow racists out there. But there's also no doubt, I think, that a pattern like this is not produced by that sort of racism. That it's a different racism, maybe a more fundamental racism, a different, more fundamental inequality. And if we were to talk about how to solve that, we would look beyond the simple image of a hateful person. We would look to structures of poverty or education or the stupid war on drugs, structural problems that require we think of a more difficult task, a task of solving this inequality without focused picking out the evil of individuals, picking out the evil or the outrage. But we don't do that. We can't do that. Not because it's hard for people to understand these other issues as contributing to this kind of racism, but the focus on simple injustice, this focus on the outrage, the focus on the difference between the good and the evil in this story, pays. It pays the structures of media that talk to us about this. It pays even the activist organizations that want to rally us about this. Keeping it simple keeps the fury going. And so while we get nothing done, we remain angry and focused in the simple injustice we see. Here's another example, tied directly to what I want to talk about today. The simple injustice around the institution that is Congress. We all know that over the past 30 years, the perception of the confidence in this institution has collapsed. 7% have confidence in the institution of Congress. The jewel, the crown jewel of our democracy, according to our framers, Article 1, Congress, 7% of us trust. More than 50% call the institution corrupt, quote unquote. And when we talk about it being corrupt, we focus on people like Blagojevich or people like Cunningham or Jack Abramoff or William Jefferson, people we think of as criminals. And again, I think there's no doubt that there are criminals. There's quid pro quo corruption inside of this institution, no doubt. But there's also no doubt that the failure of this institution is not produced by that form of corruption. It's a different kind of corruption. It's a more fundamental kind of corruption. It's not bad souls engaging in criminal acts. It's good souls engaged in a system that drives to this corruption. And if we wanted to solve that corruption, we would have to look elsewhere. Look elsewhere from beyond the prison walls. But we don't do that. We can't do that, not because it's hard. Our focus is on the simple injustice, the outrage of thinking of this institution in these good versus evil terms, because it pays. It makes it easier to organize around it. It makes it easier to vilify the results that you don't like. Keeping it simple keeps the fury going while we get nothing done in fixing the problem it represents. This simple injustice hides the real injustices. And the real work that it's going to take to fix it. Okay, so if we wanted to think beyond the simple, to understand something beyond the simple injustice, what would it be, at least as it relates to the institution I know something about, Congress? What are the real problems here? At the end of August, Hong Kong discovered something which triggered an incredible revolution in the streets, first by young people and then joined by people from across the city. What they discovered was the method Hong Kong would be forced to adopt for electing their governor. China had promised in 2007 that the chief executive by 2017 would be popularly elected. But at the end of August, the China's People Congress laid out the procedure. And as the procedure described, the ultimate aim is the selection of the chief executive by universal suffrage upon nomination by a broadly representative nominating committee in accordance with democratic procedures, a nominating committee. A committee composed of 1,200 citizens, which means about 0.024% of Hong Kong. Remember that number, 0.024% of Hong Kong. So what the Chinese were describing was this two-stage process. There was an election where all the citizens in Hong Kong would have the right to vote, but there was a nomination process where the 1,200, select 1,200, would have to vote. And you had to do well in the nominating process to be able to run in the election. A two-stage process with a filter in the middle between the two stages. And that's what triggered the strike in Hong Kong, because the view was this filter was biased. As protesters described, the 1,200 would be dominated by a pro-Beijing business and political elite. As Martin Lee, the chairman of the Hong Kong Democratic Party, put it, we want genuine universal suffrage in Hong Kong, not democracy with Chinese characteristics. But is this particular feature Chinese? And the answer is, it's not, unless Boss Tweed was an ancient Chinese prophet. Because as Tweed put it, quote, I don't care who does the electing as long as I get to do the nominating. Now, we should describe the system that Tweed was constructing. Let's call it Tweedism. Tweedism has this form. There's two steps, at least, a nominating process where the Tweeds vote, an electing process where the citizens vote, and a filter in between. That's Hong Kong's system. That's what Boss Tweed wanted, too. And of course, in the history of democracy in America, there's a long history of Tweedism in America, most dramatically in the Old South. It's embarrassing to recognize that in 1870, America passed an amendment to the Constitution that guaranteed to African American males the right to vote. The perception at the time that was passed was that this would be the future of democracy in America. In fact, for the next period, the future looked more like this. For 95 years, there was a concerted effort to exclude African Americans from the ability to vote, no place more ambitiously than the state of Texas, which enacted by law an all-white primary. So in the Old South, there's a general election where all citizens got to vote, African Americans too, if they could register. But there's a white primary where only whites get to vote. And you had to do well in the old primary to be able to run in the general election, a two-stage process which excluded, in the critical first step, African Americans from the system, with the consequence, obviously, that we had a democracy that was responsive to the whites only. Now, that's a profound and embarrassing stage of Tweedism in America. But let's think about Tweedism in the new America. Because in America today, we take it for granted that campaigns will be privately funded. funding of campaigns is an essential step to getting elected to any major office. So we have a two-stage process, a nominating process where the funders vote, an electing process where the citizens vote. Now, to get the funders' vote, you have to campaign for it, which means you need to raise money for it. So candidates spend, for Congress, candidates spend anywhere between 30 and 70% of their time raising money to run the campaigns to get them elected. They do it in things like this, where they have parties, where they say for $500 you get to come to a reception, $1,000 a photo op, and $2,400 a photo op, meet and greet, and a VIP reception. This is the game that gets played. But more importantly, they spend an extraordinary amount of time dialing for dollars. 2 to 4 hours a day calling people they've never met, developing a sensitivity, an awareness about how what they do will affect their ability to raise money. B.F. Skinner gave us this image of the Skinner box, where any stupid animal could learn which buttons it needed to push in order to get the sustenance it needed. This is the picture of the modern American congressperson. As the modern American congressperson looks, learns which buttons must be pushed to get the sustenance he or she needs. We develop in a life like this a sixth sense, an awareness about what is needed to satisfy the obligation. They become, in the words of the X-Files, shapeshifters, as they constantly adjust their views in light of what they know will help them to raise money. Leslie Byrne, a Democrat from Virginia, describes when she went to Congress, she was told by a colleague, quote, always lean to the green. Then to clarify, she went on, he was not an environmentalist. So this system is a two-stage process with the filter in the middle, begging the question, is the filter biased? And of course, that depends on who the funders are. Now, in this recent election, we have almost complete data. Here's what we know about who the funders are. In 2014, about 5.4 million people contributed at least a dollar to any congressional campaign, which means about 1.75% of America contributed to campaigns. But if you take that 1.75 of America, the top 100 gave as much as the bottom 4.75 million contributors. So the top 100 outdoes or gives as much as the bottom 4.75, but still, this is only less than 2% of America that we're talking about. So if you look at people who gave $2,600 at least, that means that's about 0.04% of America gave $2,600, about 122,000, which is a little less than the total number of people named Lester in the United States, which is why I called America Lesterland in my TED talk, a place where this tiny, tiny number has even that small amount of influence. If you look at $10,000 or more, that's 0.008% of America. That's 26,000 Americans, which is a little less than the total number of people named Sheldon in the United States. Or if you think about the effect of the Supreme Court's decision, or the decision that created the Super PAC, in 2012, 132 Americans gave 60% of the Super PAC money that was spent in that election cycle. It's about the same number of people as named Adolf in the United States. So whether it's Lesterland or Sheldon City or Adelphia, the point is we have a system where the tiniest, tiniest fraction of the 1% dominate this first stage in our election process. A two-stage election, a general election where we're all invited to participate, in some states if you have an ID, and then a green primary in America. And you must do well in the green primary to be able to run in the general election. Not always. There are people like Jerry Brown. I get it. But the point is, you believe and your campaign manager believes you must do well in the green primary. And so you live your life as if the green primary is everything, meaning a majority of Americans, the vast majority of Americans, are excluded from this critical first step, with the consequence that we have a democracy responsive to the funders and maybe only.
You're listening to Harvard Law Professor and legal activist Lawrence Lessig on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Martin Galens and Ben Page published this incredible study last year trying to measure the effect of the economic elites on political decisions. So they gathered the largest empirical study of actual policy decisions of our government in the history of political science. And they tried to relate the actual decisions of our government to the views of the economic elites and then organized interests and then the average voter. And what they found with respect to the economic elite is a graph that's intuitive. If you're saying the percent favoring a proposed policy change is the probability of that policy actually being adopted goes up. So that's the way you'd expect it would be. More support it, more likely it will be adopted. Something similar with interest groups, too. The more who support it, the higher the probability that it goes up. This is a responsive system for economic elites or organized interest groups. But here's the graph for the average citizens. That's a flat line. That flat line means, regardless of the percentage of average citizens who support something, that has no effect on its probability of being adopted. As they describe in English, when the preferences of the economic elites and the stands of organized interest groups are controlled for, the preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact on public policy. This is a democracy where the average voter's views don't matter to the probability of a policy being adopted. Or here's one context in which that consequence is quite dramatic. Professor Chernova at BART put together this graph to describe the change in the distribution of average income growth over different periods across our history coming out of recessions, for example. So here's the first period they're talking about. So this is showing the top 10% is getting 20%, the bottom 90% is getting 80%. You might have trouble with that or not, but the point is the bottom 90% is getting significantly more than the top 10. Here's how that carries out across the next period. Where the last period, the 2009 to 2012 recovery, the bottom 90% actually lose income relative to the top 10% who gain more than the total amount that would otherwise be allocated. This change, according to Hacker and Pearson, is tied directly to changes in government policy. And changes in government policy are tied directly to the influence of the Tweeds in our democracy. This is Tweedism, too. It's not a system dominated by a pro-Beijing business and political elite. It's a green primary dominated by just a business and economic elite. And the thing to see is that it is just as extreme as the story in Hong Kong. Remember I told you 0.024% is the percentage of Hong Kong that gets to be in the nominating committee. Well, if you asked what percentage of voters maxed out to just one candidate, they gave $5,200, that number, the percentage of voters, is 0.024%. Now, many people would say $5,200 doesn't get you real influence, so it's worse than 0.024% of the average of the percentage of voters. But the point is, it is as tiny, it is as distorting, and it is just as wrong. This is the problem. What does it do? What's its effect? Francis Fukuyama's recent book, Political Order and Political Decay, describes America not as a democracy, not as an aristocracy, not as a plutocracy, not even as a kleptocracy. America, Fukuyama says, has become a vetoocracy, a vitocracy. And by that he means America, the vitocracy, is a system where it is trivially easy now for economically powerful groups to block any change. And the reason for that is tied, in his view, largely to our systems of checks and balances and to our polarized political culture. But in addition to those two, it's tied to the tiny number of funders who fund campaigns. Because in a system where such a tiny, tiny number are funding campaigns, what that means is that a tiny, tiny fraction, that's really tiny, of that tiny number has the power to block reform because their disagreement with reform is enough to stop the policymakers from adopting it. And this is not just reform on the left. What this means is change, any change, at least if it's against organized money, whether from the left or the right, fails. Any change, including yours. Everyone coming into a room like this has an issue you care about. It could be climate change, healthcare, the debt, tax policy. I don't care what the issue is. At the federal level, you all have an issue you think is important, and I'm sure most of you spend an extraordinary amount of your free time, if there is such a thing anymore, on that issue, giving your money to support causes that would advance this issue. But the point to see is that even if your issue is, in your view, the most important issue, change on that issue won't happen until we change this corruption first. This issue, this corrupting influence of the way we fund campaigns, is the first issue because it blocks the ability of our democracy to control, to steer the direction of our democracy. It stops us from having that control. We are like the bus driver who discovers his steering wheel is no longer connected to the axle. This is our democracy because of the influence of the way we fund campaigns. So what's the solution here? Now, the truth is the solution is not hard to describe. If this is the picture, this tweedist system, and the problem is the biased filter at the center, the solution is to find a way either to eliminate the filter or to eliminate the bias. There are lots of examples of how this could be done. Number of Republicans, in the spirit of Teddy Roosevelt, perhaps, have begun to push ideas like vouchers as a way to solve this funding problem. Vouchers, where you imagine, let's say, every voter gets a voucher. Think of it as like a Target card or a Starbucks card, a stored value card that allows them to allocate a certain amount of money to candidates running for office. And candidates can take those vouchers, let's say a $50 voucher here, Grant, if they agree to limit the contributions they take to vouchers and, let's say, small contributions, $100, Franklin. Now, $50 a voter would be about $7 billion. In 2014, the total amount spent by congressional candidates was $1.5 billion, which means that this is real money, but the point is the voucher system would mean money coming from many, many people, not just the 0.04%. or not just the 0.024%. So it filters, perhaps, because it's not everybody who's going to participate, but it's not biased in the way the current system is biased by allocating that funding power to the tiny, tiny fraction of the 1%. Democrats have been pushing this idea of matching funds. John Sarbanes from Maryland has a Government by the People Act that basically takes small contributions and multiplies them up to 9 to 1 to make them much more valuable. So $100 becomes $1,000 because of this 9-to-1 match. Encouraging candidates to get lots of small contributions. Again, many, many small contributions, not contributions coming from the 0.04% or the 0.024%. Still a filter, but not biased in the way the current system is biased. With both of these systems, the thing that matters more than the current system is, God forbid, votes. Voters, that's what's mattering to the democracy. Equal votes from equal citizens. To describe the solution to this problem is not hard. So then why don't we have the solution? Why don't we have political movements to push for this solution? Now, the political experts tell us the reason is most people don't care about it. Most people look at this corruption and they're okay with it, or they're okay with it relative to other issues they want to fight about. And I don't think that's actually true. And the evidence for this comes from a series of studies. The most recent we did was in December of 2013. We asked the public, how important is it to you that we reduce the influence of money in politics? The answer was 96% of Americans said it was important. 96%. But the very next question we asked was, how likely do you think it is that we'll reduce the influence of money in politics? The answer is 91% said it was not likely. So just like most of us wish we could fly like Superman, at least 96% of us, but because at least 91% of us are convinced we can't, we don't throw ourselves off of tall buildings regularly, we accept, we are resigned to our human mortal status, and we live life the way one would, assuming you can't fly from the ground or from tall buildings. So too with this corruption. We accept it. We don't organize to do anything about it because we believe there's nothing that can be done. We have added to Ben Franklin's slogan, "There's nothing is certain but death and taxes," by adding, "and a corrupt government." These elements are taken for granted. That means the question here is, how do we resist this resignation? What's the strategy for fighting resignation? The problem is not convincing people there's a problem. The problem is convincing people there's a solution that could actually be adopted. So what is it that we could do for that? Well, as many of you know, because I'm sure many of you were supporters, the beginning of the year, in March, we announced we were going to launch something called the May Day Project. May Day as in the distress signal. Saying we are going to be a May Day for this democracy. And the objective of this May Day project was to be a kind of super PAC to end all super PACs. Question was, what would it take to run a series of campaigns that would eventually win a Congress committed to fundamental reform? And we would fund that amount initially by kickstarting, sort of. You can't really kickstart political campaigns, but kickstart in the sense of contingently fund this amount to run this experiment. So kickstart a certain amount from the bottom up and then get as much of that matched from the top down as we could with the ultimate objective of winning a Congress committed to fundamental reform. And so the plan we laid out was to run a pilot in 2014 and then based on the success of that pilot, a campaign to win in 2016 and then to push legislation in 2017 and then in 2019 to prepare to protect it by passing whatever constitutional reforms would be needed to defend it against the Supreme Court. And in the first stage, we were able to raise $11 million from more than 57,000 contributors around the country. Yeah, that's the good news. With the objective to elect candidates committed to this fundamental reform. Now, the truth is, with that as the objective, the project was a bust. Because out of the 8 candidates we supported, 2 won, only one of those races was really competitive. So people look at this and say, in fact, this demonstrates the public doesn't care. Now, indeed, it's not as bad as that looks. If you look at the report we've put together of the data we were able to pull from surveys both before and after, it shows a significant number of voters are deeply committed and care about this issue. Just in the tsunami of the partisan election of 2014, that wasn't enough to overcome the strong partisan division. But the truth is, we made a bet that we could demonstrate the salience of this, and we lost that bet because we didn't prove, at least to the skeptics, a system that could scale. So there was no clear path to 2016, which was our objective, to get us to a place in 2016 where we could elect a Congress committed to fundamental reform. Now, when we lost in this dramatic way, the truth was, one part of me was relieved at the defeat. Because the truth about politics as it's run today is that it is deeply dissatisfying and disgusting in most of how it works. And the constraint of politics today is almost impossible to imagine using to educate people in a constructive way about these issues. I likened it to trying to teach an algebra course by screaming out of the windows on Harvard Yard the various aspects of the lesson as students are walking through, because most people don't want to hear the message that's being broadcast to them while they're trying to watch a Patriots game. Most people want to ignore it. So the method for communicating to them must communicate in a way that is incredibly constrained, almost impossible to move people. But the other part that echoed a kind of guilt was how it felt inauthentic to the ultimate objective of this movement, because its game was an insider's game. We were electing regular candidates inside a political system to fix the problem with other insiders. And the problem with that is that we, Americans, don't believe insiders when they tell us they're going to fix the problem. Claris did a poll and found 80% of Americans believe that the reforms that have been passed have been designed more to help current members of Congress get reelected than to improve the system. We are cynical about the reformers as much as we are cynical about everything else. And so that means we've got to find a way to stand outside the system to force the change within the system. That the challenge here is to be authentically outsider in the effort to force change on the inside. That sounds like a harder problem, and in some ways it is. There was something so appealing about the idea of demonstrating that throwing up a message around the corruption of Congress would be enough to rally voters and then raising the hundreds of millions of dollars necessary to win a Congress. There was something clean and simple about it, even if there was something somewhat corrupt about it. So this forces us to think, what is the way to go forward that could force a change on the outside? From the outside, a choice of change on the inside. And I'm going to describe three elements of that strategy. One element is to make the change plausible. One element is to make Congress panic. And one element is to make the issue presidential. Okay, the first is the plausible. Mayday originally had this idea of electing a Congress. The bet was we could demonstrate the power of the message to elect candidates. This was a bad year to make that bet. So now we have a horrible word of the valley to pivot, to figure out what the work is that can contribute to the project. So what are we doing now? The objective now is to figure a way to turn the army around and to focus it on a much more manageable project of recruiting the incumbents to commit to reform. So if there's a majority in Congress and there are those who are committed to reform and a resulting gap, the project is to shrink the gap. To shrink the gap to make it seem plausible that we could actually get fundamental reform. Not necessarily a majority committed to one of these versions, whether vouchers or matching funds, but a majority committed to fundamental reform of some form. And so how will we actually deploy this? Well, right now, in a top secret project that gets announced at South by Southwest, there is a strategy for a platform to enable to using the tools of this infrastructure we call the internets, an incredibly powerful ability to begin to recruit targeted actions in districts to convince voters in districts to get their members to commit to reform. And we believe it's feasible to get within striking distance, not a majority, but within striking distance by the end of 2015. And in March, this structure is announced, and we launch the project to bring about the commitment on Republicans and Democrats both to this system of fundamental reform, to make it seem plausible. But that's not going to be enough, getting close. Much more interesting is creating panic.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features Harvard Law professor and legal activist Lawrence Lessig. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So this guy's George Mason. George Mason was one of the framers of our Constitution. 2 days before the Constitution was published, the draft in Philadelphia, Mason noticed a problem. The only way to amend the Constitution at that time was a provision that gave Congress the power to propose amendments. So George Mason stood up and said on the floor of the Constitutional Convention, "What if Congress is the problem? A system where only Congress can amend is not much of a system if Congress is the problem." And it's the first known instance of the Simpsons duh that we have in the history of America, as the framers recognized they had this fundamental flaw. And so they created a second way to amend the Constitution. Article 5 gives the states the power to demand that Congress call a convention. Not a constitutional convention, which has the power to amend the Constitution, but a convention for a very limited purpose to propose amendments. Now, what's clear is that the idea of a convention terrifies Washington. It terrifies D.C. to imagine this entity being created that has the power to propose amendments. Even though those amendments require 38 states to ratify, the idea of an alternative power emerging or being called into being by this process terrifies them. And the closer we get to the magic number the Constitution specifies, 34 states calling for a convention, the more the panic grows. Now, what's not recognized is that right now there are between 24 and 28 states who have passed resolutions calling on Congress to call an Article 5 convention. And Vermont and California and Illinois have last year passed proposals to call for a convention specifically related to the corrupting influence of money in politics. And as more of these organizations push for more states to join, we will, in the next 2 years, get incredibly close to the magic number. I think we will probably get over the magic number. And as that happens, Congress will respond, because historically it has always responded to cut off the convention movement by giving people who are pushing for a convention what they want. And we may, through this process, get what we want from them even before there's a convention. So the best example of this is the amendment that gave us an elected Senate. The Constitution originally had a Senate picked by state legislatures. People didn't like that. They thought the Senate would be filled with rich people who were corruptly selected. So they said we should change that to have a directly elected Senate. The Senate was not going to have anything to do with that. There was a process for calling for an Article 5 convention. When they got within one state of enough states to call for an Article 5 convention, Congress quickly sent out the 17th Amendment that created the elected Senate. So that panic produced reform, and that reform was central to bringing about what was perceived to be a solution to the problem. And that's the same dynamic we should expect here. The closer we get to forcing a constitutional movement, the closer we get to achieving something from what Congress might do. And finally, and maybe most important immediately, is presidential. This issue has got to be made presidential. Because in the modern American political system, reform only ever happens if it comes with a president pushing it. Not just a president pushing it. Some people might remember there was this guy, Barack Obama, who talked about this problem precisely and promised to address this problem precisely. But once he walked into 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and looked around, he realized there was no chance Congress would ever address this problem. So he just dropped the issue completely. So we need to get a Congress close to being able to pass it, and then a president who wants to pick it up, to make this issue presidential. Now, it's not their natural wish to talk about this issue. If you look at Gallup Politics's polls related to corruption in government, in 2000, it was not even an issue on the top 10 list. 2004, not an issue. In 2008, it was number 4 on the top 10 list of issues Americans thought the president should address. In 2012, it was number 2. Number 2, second only to jobs, corruption in the way our government functions. And by corruption, no one was thinking about Rob Blagojevich at that time. They were talking about and thinking about the extraordinary money from the Sheldon Adelsons or the Koch brothers or whatever favorite person you want to point to. That was number 2. But if you looked at the websites of Romney and Obama, nowhere in the discussion of any of the issues did they even mention the problem. And indeed, I had a researcher look at it, and it's the first time in as far as we can see when an issue on the top 10 of Gallup's list was not even mentioned by either candidate in the addressed policy issues that they promised to take up. They don't want to talk about this issue. It's too embarrassing to talk about this issue. It's hypocritical to talk about this issue, so they will avoid it as much as they can. So the challenge in 2016 is to figure out how to get them to talk about this issue as they go around and engage in the rain dance to convince people to support them about whatever issue they want to get people to support them for. The challenge is, how do we get to turn the table and to force them to consider what they'd rather not consider? How do we get them to address a topic which they'd rather not have to address? And that's the objective of this organization in New Hampshire called the New Hampshire Rebellion. And by rebellion, that doesn't mean rebellion against the government. It's to rebel against this agenda that the politicians will bring, the presidential candidates will bring, to not talk about this issue, to rebel by forcing them to say, how are you going to end the system of corruption in Washington? By recruiting people to ask this question again and again in New Hampshire. Now, New Hampshire, of course, is a prime target for this. It is the critical presidential primary election. It also is a state with an important precedent related to this issue. In June 1999, John McCain went to New Hampshire and made the system of corruption in Washington the focus of his campaign, and of course, that focus led to him winning the primary in New Hampshire. But just before he had done that, New Hampshire had a tie to this issue that was much more powerful for many of the people who continue to talk about it. The tie was this woman, a woman named Doris Haddock, aka Granny D, who on January 1st, 1999, started a walk in Los Angeles to cross the country to Washington, D.C., 3,200 miles. She began at the age of 88. She arrived at the age of 90. Walking into Washington, there were hundreds of people following her, including a whole bunch of congressmen who had gotten in their cars and driven out for the last mile to come in and walk Granny D, celebrating the incredible importance she had focused on addressing what was then for her the fundamental issue, the corruption of the system of campaign finance reform. And what the New Hampshire Rebellion seeks to do is to revive this. By remixing a bit the Granny D walk, nobody has the time for 3,200 miles, but last year we did the first instance of this walk across New Hampshire in January. So she walked longer, we walked colder, a total of 190 miles in New Hampshire. Did I mention in January? A walk which totaled about 210 people across the course of the walk, reaching tens of thousands of new recruits in New Hampshire who have signed up to join this cause to force candidates to talk about this issue in the primary, and reaching a million people in the state and around the state of New Hampshire talking about and focused on this issue. And this January 11th, the anniversary of Aaron's death, the second of these walks happened. But this time, not just one, there will be 4 routes, all converging in Concord, the capital, on the 21st, which is the 5th anniversary of the Supreme Court's contribution to this mess, the case of Citizens United. Now, the objective here is to recruit 50,000 committed voters in New Hampshire to ask this one question: how are you going to end this system of corruption in Washington? And the theory is, if enough ask that question, and if the race is sufficiently competitive, it creates an incentive, an opportunity on the Republican side, certainly, and maybe two on the Democratic side, for a candidate to pick this issue up. And if they pick this issue up and make it an issue, there's a chance that it becomes an issue in the presidential election. Now, would that be enough? In my book, Republic Lost, I was skeptical that would be enough. I also described something we could think of as the regent president. And the idea of this was, if it's impossible for people to believe that ordinary politicians will really take this issue up, maybe what we need is something that's not an ordinary politician. So imagine somebody like Gates or David Souter or Christine Whitman or, you know, my favorite. Just imagine the voice. That would be so fantastic. A non-politician who committed to run for president with one promise: that when elected, they would do one thing to pass whatever the reform is that that person thought was essential, and then to promise to resign. That's it. One thing. A regent, you know, the regent is there while the children grow up. So Washington's filled with lots of children. So it's basically, we're going to force you to grow up by taking away this corrupting influence, and I step aside. And then the ordinary politician vice president becomes the president. Now, the critical thing about this idea is that there's no ambiguity, if that person is elected, why that person was elected. You know, Barack Obama can say, I was elected for 44,000 different reasons, but this person would be elected for one reason. And there's no ability for a Congress to really push back against it if the Congress wants to survive a next election, because it's pretty clear what the American people have said. And there would be plenty of incentive by ordinary politicians to give that person what that person wanted, because it's the easiest way to get rid of that person. Because once you give them the bill, they've got to go home and you can get back to ordinary politics as usual. This system, this regent-president system, if we could find such a leader to step up and take this challenge, I think would do it, would actually bring about the kind of reform that we need. Maybe it's possible to do it without, but I think the key is to recognize that we need the president in this mix. We need to move a Congress. We need to scare a Congress. We need a president to lead. Three parts to make possible this change. Because this change is possible. It takes one statute. I think we need 15 senators and 45 representatives to switch. That's it. It's possible. It's possible if we, if you, if people like you stand up and focus not just on the simple injustice, the injustice of the corrupt criminal, but the real justice that we've got to bring back to the system, to the equality of citizens, which this system has lost. It's my view, it's my life, it's this passion that that boy started me on, that we can get it back. It's possible. But the key here is an old Harvey Milk strategy. It's possible if we give people hope that there's something that can be done. And not hope in the sense that our friend Obama has abused the term, but hope maybe in the sense that Vaclav Havel described. So here's what Havel said about hope. Hope is a state of mind, not of the world. It's a dimension of the soul. It is not prognostication. It is an orientation of the spirit and an orientation of the heart. Hope is not the same thing as joy that things are going well, or a willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously heading for success, but rather an ability to work for something because it is good. Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense. Now, something does make sense here. It's my view that this republic makes sense here, that the ideals that 225 years of struggling have evolved make sense here. There's something to hope for, and there is something even to be optimistic about. That if we organize in the way we have now the capacity to organize, there is the chance, not the certainty, the chance that we can restore this equality of citizenship again. For once, maybe it's never been here, then for once, but for all of us, that is our obligation, a moral obligation, an obligation that can inspire all if it's understood to be something that speaks to the best of our tradition, which is including and expanding and building a democracy that expands the capacity that we have. Thank you very much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Harvard Law professor and legal activist Lawrence Lessig. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Tuttle, and Maya Finley. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature fashion designer Diane von Furstenberg. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.